Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're finding art in the real world. Pianos scattered across the state, ready for the random passerby to play. A printer stirs up questions about race lying just under the surface of Southern manners. The most affecting art is not always installed in urban museums or being made in dusty studios. It's happening in the trenches, it's happening in the streets, and we're digging around to find creative people who are searching for different ways to engage audiences and express ideas. First, the art of an unseen war. Artist James Bridle runs a blog called Dronestagram, which posts pictures of landscapes targeted by the U.S. government's highly secretive drone program. Bridle uses data collected by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, or BIJ, which successfully petitioned Central Command for data on strike locations. Dronestagram's aerial photos push against the abstract and remote nature of drones, which are piloted from thousands of miles away and fly reconnaissance and bombing missions over places few of us have ever even seen or imagined. We spoke with James Bridle about his work, which adds a layer of real-world imagery to what some call video game weaponry.
What you're seeing is the landscapes of these battlefields, essentially. It's very strange to me that we hear a lot about these places on the news, or in fact, sometimes we don't hear very much about them at all, but we very rarely see them. They take place in locations that pretty much none of us have visited and very few of us are likely to. And in fact, no journalists visit there. And in fact, no kind of troops visit there at all. These are landscapes that are kind of only accessible to the military via these kind of robotic planes. But there are people there, and there are houses there, and there are roads, and there are schools, and there's all this kind of stuff. But it's a battlefield that we don't see. Mm. And we don't think very much about that because we're so used to kind of 24/7 television and newspaper coverage.
Yeah, we can discern cars, buildings, outbuildings, pictures, of course, taken high above the earth, with the odd effect of making them appear a little flat and abstract. And I was thinking, looking at them, you could be a passenger in a drone if there were such a thing. Is that what you're aiming for, the look of what one would see if one were in one?
Yeah, I mean, the aesthetic of these things is very much the kind of the drone's eye view of this landscape. I think that's a shame in one sense because I am trying to bring these things closer. Mm-hmm. I am trying to make them distinctly more visible. And of course, there is always a distancing effect by a kind of aerial shot of this nature. You know, in some cases, locals have taken more up-to-date pictures of these places, and you can go onto the internet and see them. But this is kind of as close as it's possible to get, really, from a distance. But I think that's quite important and key as well. We're not being shown these places, but we do have the technology to access them to some extent.
Mm. Dronestagram has been up for a few months, but this is not your first project looking at drone warfare. I was looking at a previous project called Drone Shadows, where you traced out the shadows, like a silhouette of a drone on the ground, in parking lots and on streets. I'm wondering, James, what is it about drones that your work is exploring?
My work has always explored the kind of strange intersections of technology and culture. So I used to be a publisher, and from then I was exploring why literature has changed by coming into contact with ebooks and the internet. And from there, it's become a wider exploration of how all of culture is changed by its encounter with technology and the network. For me, drones stand quite specifically for the kind of the very distant reach of the network. They're this kind of disembodied technology, or they're very much embodied, but distanced from us. They allow us to reach out and see and act at this kind of incredible distance, just as the network does. But unlike a lot of the kind of social tools that we use every day, it doesn't feel like it's bringing us closer together. In fact, in this case, it's being used to kind of obfuscate and conceal. So Dronestagram is intended to kind of bridge that gap, basically, to bring together those two technologies, the same technology which is being used both to conceal and to bring together and to show them both. And the Drone Shadows project is quite similar in many ways, because it struck me that I'd certainly never seen a drone in real life. I'd never stood in front of one. And when I started thinking about it, I had no real way of visualizing it. I had no idea how big it really was. So the project started very simply as sketching one of these things out in order to understand its size and therefore to be able to think about it more clearly.
I'm looking at Dronestagram now. Here's one entry from October 23rd, 2012 at 5:27 p.m. in Yemen. An evening strike on a car killed at least four alleged Al-Qaeda members in the Marib province, several miles outside Marib city, sources reported. And then, you know, they talk about the bodies blown to pieces, not identified. You have several different sources here, references of the Associated Press, AFP, Reuters, Yemen Post, Long War Journal, Xinhua. Now, you're an artist, but also serving, I think, as a reporter in a sense. Looking at these several sources that you reference, you must check these things out. Are you prepared to be in that position, James, to be looked at as, you know, sort of an authority on drones?
I wouldn't call myself an authority on drones in any way, but I mean, I've certainly been interested in this area for some time, so I've learned a huge amount. And this work sits atop a huge amount of other work done by professional journalists who are far more skilled at the investigatory portion of this than I am. But what I am, I guess, interested in is how we tell these stories in the language of the network. At a time when, you know, we're bombarded with kind of news stories that are very easy to kind of gloss over and ignore, we spend all our time in kind of other places, in places like Instagram and on Twitter and on Tumblr, these social networks, which portray, you know, our personal reality, our social reality, the reality of our friends. So trying to speak about current events, about what I consider to be important events in those spaces and in the language of the network itself, I think is a kind of a writerly and artistic task that's very closely tied to journalism.
James Bridle, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The artist James Bridle, he blogs at The New Aesthetic and Book2.org. And we do have a link to his Dronestagram Tumblr to see Google Earth images of sites targeted by drone strikes, as well as the IBJ project reporting on drone strikes. There's plenty of information there. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org and also on Facebook and Twitter. And now we move from the bird's eye view of a clandestine contemporary war to a richly illustrated record of a historic and secretive weapons project that forever changed the world, the atomic bomb.
As the Atomic Energy Commission's newest A-bomb tests make headlines, just released official films take you behind the scenes of previous tests for close-ups of secret research never before made public. Here in an Air Force laboratory plane circling high above the target, volunteers test their visual reactions to the cosmic brilliance of an atomic burst. Protective methods against the intense glare are proven by the ultimate test.
There's not a lot to see in Los Alamos, New Mexico these days. A little over 67 years ago, the desert site was immortalized in one of the most terrifying and iconic series of images made by humans. There, a group of scientists captured on film the first atomic bomb test, a speck of light transforming into an orb burning hotter than the surface of the sun that then turned into a mushroom cloud, now a universal symbol of colossal destruction and a new phase in human history. Jonathan Fetter-Vorm is co-founder of Two Fine Chaps, a graphic imprint dedicated to adapting and illustrating classic works of literature and natural science. He's also author and illustrator of Trinity, a graphic history of the first atomic bomb, about the events that led to the bomb's creation. And Jonathan joins us now from Argo Studios in New York to tell us more. Jonathan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. And really, I guess, deeply moved, I think, by looking at this story again, all in black and white, a long, winding story of both history and science and human capacity for discovery and destruction. What made you want to explore the first atomic bomb? And where do you begin with something like that?
My earliest memories of the story were actually being told about the project by my grandfather, who worked at the Hanford site, which is where they built the first industrial-scale plutonium reactor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed by the mystery of it all. He, of course, worked on this project for years and had no idea what he was doing because everybody was kept in secret until the day the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. And so that early mystery is sort of what propelled me down this path. And it's interesting you bring up those early images that they took at the Trinity site.
Mm-hmm.
When I first saw those photographs of the bombs exploding in the first hundredths of a second, they're just uncanny. They're very hard to describe and very hard to draw as well.
And you sort of slow them down, obviously, and get into that mystery.
Yeah, try to preserve that moment for as long as possible.
At Trinity, again, let's remind our listeners, is this site where that initial test took place?
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's the code name for the test and is now called the Trinity site. It was a word coined by Dr. Oppenheimer. No one's quite sure why he chose that. He left some enigmatic notes to that effect of quoting from a John Donne poem. But yes, that's the code name for the test.
He was quite a philosophical sort. And of course, along with the events, the historical events, you have historical characters, Truman, Stalin, Churchill. You seem to like Oppenheimer a bit. We see him, he's always lighting a cigarette or has one hanging out of his mouth. Were you especially fascinated with him?
I was. And again, it comes back to this idea of the mystery. He became a good symbol for the difficulty of this topic in general. He was a man who held quite radically different positions about the nature of atomic bombs throughout his career. And so I kept coming back to him as sort of this touchstone for the fact that these are very hard issues to grapple. And a sort of ambivalence is in a way a very honest approach to this.
Mm-hmm. He says, in fact, you write in the book, speaking years later, he recalled his reaction to the first test. I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, and now I became death, the destroyer of worlds.
Yeah, it's quite a poignant response to the test.
Yeah, I can see this, you know, this graphic novel is a great teaching tool, but a subject that's very difficult for young kids. So which demographic do you think the book is best suited for?
Well, when I was writing it, I was hoping to make it accessible both to high schoolers and maybe early college students. But really, I want it to be something that anyone, probably above the age of 15 can read, maybe even younger. It does deal with some very intense issues, but I try to do it in a way that makes it accessible to a very wide audience.
But you didn't choose a kind of chronological narrative. What was behind that for you?
Well, I was experimenting with trying to tell the story in a way that reflected the momentum of the history. The bomb came out of years worth of work from scientists all over the world. And so there's a lot of jumping around. And part of what I wanted to do was show how once all these pieces start falling into place, as you get closer and closer to the date of the bomb test, certain outcomes become inevitable. There's a sort of critical momentum to it all. So that required a lot of jumping back and forth.
You come up with some great visual metaphors to help us understand concepts. You know, of course, there's the falling dominoes. That's one of them. But anything that you came up with that was really your favorite, you thought, I really got it that time.
The balls of clay, I was trying to describe how uranium enrichment works and really try to illustrate how difficult a task it is to separate these two isotopes of an atom, which are, for all intents and purposes, they are the same, but isotope 235 is much more reactive, and so they need it exclusively for the bomb. So the image I came up with was trying to take a ball of black clay and a ball of white clay and mixing them together until it's this kind of gray clay, and the task of enrichment is tantamount to separating the colors again from each other once they're all mixed.
This story, this history, is so shaded in controversy and also secrecy, as you said. You can't help but feel like there are many details that are left out of our official history. Were there any parts of the book that you felt were brushed over, that you couldn't find historical references on?
Actually, a lot of the technology and a lot of the work at Los Alamos is now in the public domain. It's declassified. There is still quite a lot to investigate in what the government knew about the effects of radiation before and immediately after the dropping of the bomb. There's a lot of that material is still classified. And I touched on it briefly, the discovery of what doctors called Disease X, the radiation that affected survivors of the attacks in Japan. Mm-hmm. The official story early on was that the government was unprepared for the radioactive fallout that was affecting the survivors.
It's not an extremely graphic history, you know, in the way that a lot of sort of graphic novels or comics are. Still haunting. I really want to thank you for sharing it with us and sharing your time today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Jonathan Fettervorm, the writer and artist behind Trinity, a graphic history of the first atomic bomb. It's a hardcover graphic novel, and you can find more in the book and on his other work. He's done some great work on historical books like The Nature of Things by Lucretius Moby Dick at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, art we can afford to buy and learn from. A conversation with printmaker and activist Amos Kennedy when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Printing as a vocation attracts many young men and women because it offers real opportunities for steady work, good pay, and advancement.
Printing was not the first career choice for Amos Kennedy. He was 40 when he left a lucrative job at AT&T to try his hand at being what he calls a humble Negro printmaker. From his workshop in Detroit, he hand-makes posters, pamphlets, and cards that provoke questions about art and race and social inequality. Here are a couple of examples. Coffee makes you black. Wear the old coat, buy the new book. And proceed and be bold. The latter is also the title of a 2008 documentary film about Amos's unconventional journey. We talked to him while he was artist in residence at Dartmouth College. Humble Negro printer. Why don't you say great artist, acknowledged all over the world, artist in residence?
I have serious issues with the title of artist because I think in the latter half of the 20th century, the term artist and art has been usurped from the masses, and it's become this almost pristine, high-level vocation. Artists have a tendency to do very conceptual things, and some people I know who are artists feel that their work is not for the unintellectual, that there is so much meaning and layering to their work that the average citizen would not get it. And so that type of artist I object to. And also, we are all artists because we are all creative and we all make things. So why make this distinction? I'm an artist that puts it out there a little bit more than the average citizen.
And you do put it out there. You make these posters. Can you describe what your posters look like to people who are listening?
Well, my posters are based upon the show card poster that was popular from the latter half of the 19th century to the mid-20th century. They range in size, but mine are 12.5 by 19. They were placed in windows of merchant stores and on telephone poles and on alongside buildings to advertise circuses, minstrel shows, concerts, and things of that nature. So they're made out of chipboard or heavy cardboard stock. Traditionally, they would have been done on white paper, but I've been using chipboard brown and gray. It has an earthy feel to it, and I like that.
This printing, as you said, was really popular in 19th and 20th century, but really kind of went out of fashion, I guess, in the mid-20th century when other forms of printing presses came on board. But now this letterpress printing is in the midst of a kind of a renaissance. What is it that attracted you? You were working, very successful, upper middle class, African-American programmer.
Negro.
I'm sorry, a Negro programmer. It's really hard for me to say. It's not really in fashion.
Kind of like letterpress at the early last part of the 20s.
Okay, so what is it that drew you to it, Amos?
Well, I had studied calligraphy for a number of years, so I've always been interested in letter shapes. But the problem I had with calligraphy is that I would do a piece, and as I got towards the end of it, I would misspell a word, and I would have to start all over again. Letterpress, if you misspell a word, all you have to do is pop out the misspelling, correct it, and then you can start over. So, and also, I loved the idea of multiples, because multiples allow for a sharing. And I believe sincerely that we as a species exist because of the generosity that we have for each other.
So sharing, is that the idea of printing posters? You can actually print quite a few of them. Do people buy the posters, or are you just putting them up as statements?
What I try to do is I try to be the gateway drug to buying art. So I sell my posters for $15 a piece. And that is something that a parent could afford for their child. I believe that art should be affordable. And also I believe that children should have art and become art patrons. So over the course of their life, they will decorate their homes not with the manufactured art, but with art made by that individual, and have a relationship with the artist that will grow and prosper.
Well, you know, this is certainly not just decorative art. You also send something to people called, and you produce something called nappygrams. There's a sequence in the film, Proceed and Be Bold, where one of your nappygrams gets you and your partner in a little bit of trouble. You get called into the police station. Here's just a clip of that sequence.
I am assistant professor of art, School of Fine Arts, Indiana University. And also president of Nappy Niggers in Art.
Individuals at Affirmative Action had received this card marked nappygram, and it's addressed Affirmative Action as a joke. Did you guys send this card?
I sent the card. She didn't.
You sent the card. You
That's
know correct. Nothing.
That's you, Amos Kennedy, from the film Proceed and Be Bold. What's going on there?
Well, we were called in by the Indiana University Police to be interrogated, because I sent out the postcard that said affirmative action is a joke, because affirmative action is a joke in many respects. It has been usurped and used in ways that it shouldn't be used. And they felt threatened by it because I think one reason they felt threatened was that that summer there was a individual on campus that was sprouting very racist remarks, and he ended up, I think, shooting a student or someone in the community. Mm. And they did not do anything to prevent him from taking the actions that he took. And so I think it was overreaction, because if they had called me up, they would have realized that it was a part of a political statement. They may have thought it was offensive because that's their job. But as I said in the movie, they should have said, why does this individual think it's a joke, especially when he's black? Because they thought it was a white person sending it out. So just imagine when they saw this black guy show up.
Wait, not only this black guy show up, but this black guy show up pulling a wagon with a lawn jockey in it.
Yeah. With Shine. Shine is my most favorite lawn jockey. I have two right now.
You move from place to place. There's a segment in the film where you're spending time in Italy. You have residencies. You know, you're recognized all over the world. And yet you must crash into this notion of race that's pretty old and pretty entrenched wherever you go.
Well, I don't really crash into it. I think it would be better to say that I crash it into people. I was just at St. Ambrose University in Davenport, Iowa, where I had an exhibition, and they are celebrating Cornel West's, I think it's the 20th anniversary of his book, Race Matters.
Uh-huh.
And so for the poster to announce my exhibition, it was Race Matters, Racism Matters, and then post-racial my ass. So I think that we cannot underplay race, because race is a substitute actually for classism in this nation. And if we underplay race, then we will completely forget about classism. But as long as we keep knocking it, and then people say, well, there are just as many middle-class blacks as there are middle-class whites, blah, 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 then you have to admit to the classism that exists. And that is something I think that the power structure of this civilization does not want to confront.
Well, this what you're just saying reminds me of something that I think your brother in the film calls you a social irritant. Is that your role as an artist? Are you hoping to point out this sort of classism, these, let's say, inconsistencies in quote-unquote post-racial America?
I think that's my role just as a human being. I've always been an irritant, and I think that art now gives me the luxury of it being acceptable. I tell people that I'm waiting for the committee to come with my hemlock.
Would you take it, Amos, if they brought it to you?
I probably would.
So you're working very much in, almost what I would think of as a sort of southern rural tradition. And now you've moved your operation to Detroit. What does that mean for your work? Do you think it's going to change?
No, my work will remain the same. And when I think about show cards and posters the way that I do them, especially letterpress posters, I think of it as a southern iconic cultural entity.
Yeah, that's and something I'll, you see still see outside of juke joints in the South, right?
Yes, and being in Detroit, it will not change. It will. I think that there will be some variations in my style, going more to maybe a little starker, a little more modernistic at times, mm-hmm. but it will still have its roots in my Southern heritage. One reason that I moved to Detroit is that Rosa Parks, after she was exiled from the South, ended up in Detroit, and that's where she died, actually. And this is the 100th anniversary of her birth this year.
You're talking about, you know, a Southern tradition doing these letterpress posters. You know, you're right now in this kind of, you know, bastion of white society, of Puritan America, of Dartmouth. I wonder what you think that you're going to bring to these students with your work.
What I hope I bring to the students with my work is they can see the immense joy that I get from doing what I do, and that will influence them to pursue their dreams, to pursue their passion. But I don't like the word passion, because passion is about suffering, and I am far from suffering at what I do.
Printmaker Amos Kennedy there, one of many guests introduced to us by Dartmouth College's Hopkins Center for the Arts. Last summer, the Hop celebrated its 50-year anniversary, not with cake or candles, but pianos. For 1 month, 50 decorated pianos were installed in public places all around New Hampshire's Upper Valley region. The goal? To get the community playing and singing and talking together. NHPR's Todd Bookman toured the hands-on piano exhibit and filed this audio postcard.
What's your name?
Maddie.
Maddie, where are you from?
Andover, Mass.
And what do you think about having all these pianos out in public?
It's funny.
You don't always get a chance to play a piano, you know? Not many people have pianos anymore, really. But she actually wants one, so this is good. Good practice, right, Maddie?
My name is Erin Smith, and I am the outreach assistant at the Hopkins Center. There are lots of communities around the country that have done it, but not on this scale. We want to kind of break down the doors of the Hopkins Center and take music out to everybody.
Well, the singing, it needs a little help, but so far so good.
Only the good die young. That's what I said. Only the good die young. Only the good die young. You might have heard, I don't know.
Thank you.
normally just pass each other in the street without looking or glancing or saying hello are all of a sudden singing together and talking, even just as a conversation starter, like, what is that? Why is that here? You know, it really gets people talking to each other and interacting with each other, and that's part of what music is and what music does too, you know, and sharing music and finding people who you didn't know, you know, you didn't know were these talented pianists, and all of a sudden you sit down or you walk by and you see students or just random people playing beautiful music like we did outside the Hop just now.
Larry Glazer. I shouldn't sit here all day and just, I don't want to, you know, hog the place if someone else is playing, you know, wants to play.
Larry Glazer there, playing one of 50 pianos installed in public places to celebrate the 50th birthday of Dartmouth College's Hopkins Center for the Arts. The Eiffel Tower has inspired countless t-shirts, souvenirs, and sentimental works of art. Now composer Joseph Bertolozzi aims to turn the iron and latticework landmark into a gigantic instrument. He proved that he can tackle projects on a mammoth scale when he wired and then played New York's Mid-Hudson River Bridge. Here's just a sample. Bertolozzi's Tower Music Project aims to unleash the voice of the Eiffel Tower to coincide with its 125th anniversary celebration in 2014. The project has already been cleared by site administrators. The next step is to find a way to pay for it. I spoke to Bertolozzi during his bid to raise money on Kickstarter and asked him if the massive bridge music project was just a warm-up act for the Eiffel Tower.
Well, in a way, my original idea was to play the Eiffel Tower, but, you know, I quickly realized that I don't speak French. And I thought, why don't I do it on something that's in this country where I live? So I did bridge music, and that was for the Henry Hudson Quadricentennial back in 2009. And then I used that finished product as a proof of concept when I approached the Eiffel Tower administration. So I'm back to the original idea now.
It's a very different structure, a different culture, and a different meaning. Obviously, the Eiffel Tower has a very deep place in a lot of people's hearts. How will tower music be different?
When I hear the sounds, I really can't answer that exactly. When I hear the sounds, I'll be able to then determine what kind of music that I'll be writing. It'll be the same in the sense that you'll have a composer, myself, who'll be writing fixed musical compositions for this particular set of stairs and handrails and spindles and things like that. So that's what's unique about it.
I'm curious about how you approach something so huge. I mean, what's the process in your mind?
Well, first of all, you have to get permission. And, you know, I wrote to the mayor of Paris many, many times and finally got an answer. And I went and pitched this to the administration. But how do you approach the structure to break it down? That's basically it. You know, you take it all in one glance, and then you start looking at it, and you see, oh, well, here's a rail, here's a spindle, here's a retaining wall, here's a gusset, and you just break it down into small pieces.
Well, it seems to me that whenever I've been to Paris, things feel differently. Do they sound differently there, too?
I maybe with a French accent, I don't know. I've got my eye on the prize, so everything else is sort of blocked out.
Bonne chance, Joseph Bertolozzi. Good
Merci.
Luck to you.
Merci.
Composer Joseph Bertolozzi there. There's more on his plan to transform the Eiffel Tower into a giant instrument, including his effort to fund it now through his own website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, new sounds from Arab lands, improvisation and collaboration inspired by the traditional music of the Middle East, European classical, and America's jazz age. We'll hear what East meets West sounds like when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Arabic music stretches back thousands of years, European classical for centuries. American jazz came of age in the 20th century. An innovative ensemble of musicians and composers is experimenting with the union of those traditions and making lots of room to imagine, explore, and improvise. New sounds from Arab lands is five musicians from Syria, Tunisia, and Lebanon. We caught up with four of them, Kinan Asme, Jasser Al-Youssef, Basel Rajoub, and Farah Sharistan, and they performed for us. Percussionist Khaled Yassin was not able to join. Normally, we think of tradition as a kind of restraint, but as we found while talking with composer and clarinetist Kinan Asme, musical traditions can also be triggers for growth, as they were for him as a child growing up in Damascus.
I grew up in Damascus, and my basic training was Western classical music. So, back home, in my parents' apartment, we heard lots of Mozart, Brahms, and Berlioz. But also, being in a city like Damascus, you're also exposed to other types of music. So I was very curious to discover music from the Balkans, music of Turkey later on, jazz, and all sorts of things.
And it's interesting because you are, as a band, are from Syria, Beirut, Tunisia, respectively, sort of an amalgam of places in the Arab world. So I'm wondering, what is it to you, coming from traditions in different places, what does it mean to be new sounds from Arab lands? What is new here?
I mean, it's hard to put this project as something that resembles or summarizes the new sounds of the Arab world. We are part of a bigger collective, people who are actively looking for new musical vocabularies in the Arab world and beyond. We're part of a generation, I guess, who, you know, the composer/instrumentalist, trying to fuse a few things. One of them is the written music versus the improvised, but also the composer/instrumentalist type. In a way, it's not up to us to decide what is new, but we are excited about the project because it's new for us. You know, that's what keeps it exciting, is that we're trying to discover each other's musical vocabularies since we have different backgrounds. Some of us are, you know, their background is in Arabic music. Some of us are, like myself, in classical music, Western classical music. Some of us has a strong background in jazz. It's a learning journey where we get inspired by each other.
Well, let's hear some more music from the program. The composition Dream is composed by you, Kinan Asme, and performed by our guest today, New Sounds from Arab Lands. Kinan, what can you tell us about this piece?
So this is actually from a film score that I've written a few years ago, and it talks about three Filipino immigrants who, in their first winter in New York, this is post 9/11, and the hardship they went through, trying to pursue what they thought would be the American dream and ended up being an American nightmare for them. But, so the film called Rigodon, it's by two Filipino film directors, Keith Sikat and Sari Dalena. And I'm really happy with this new version that we have, myself, Jasser, and Firas.
I'm speaking with Kinan Asme. He is a composer and clarinetist with the group New Sounds from Arab Lands. And Kinan, you've talked about the importance of improvisation in this group. Do these songs change every time you play them?
In this program, I think we're trying to blur the barrier between what is composed and what is written out. Some of the best written out music is the one that sounds totally spontaneous, almost has an improvisation quality. And some of the best improvisations are ones where you think the performer really thought everything out and it sounds as if it's structured. So there are two pieces in the program. One of them is Dream. The other one is a great composition by Jasser Al-Youssef called Sama'i, which is on a traditional form. These are the only two pieces that do not involve any improvisations. But still, the music every time sounds different, and that's what is exciting about, you know, live music.
I think a lot of Americans have a pretty limited and maybe even cliched notion of Arab music. We hear a news story on the Middle East. You cue the oud. And to my Western ear, I don't discern necessarily the differences in geographies or musical traditions, but I hear, you know, a flourish of an Arabic flute or some strings, and I think, oh, okay, this is Arabic music. Is New Sounds from Arab Lands, is this ensemble teaching us more about discernment?
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think it's only the limitation of the Western ear, because some people back home, they would think that Britney Spears is all what America has to offer to the world musically as well. You know what I mean? The limitation comes, I guess, from both ends. But in a way, the instruments we play, since most of them, at least three instruments in this ensemble, are not traditional instruments, we treat the instruments as a tool only. I mean, every instrument is only a tool to say what you want to say. So it really depends, I guess, in our limited way, we're trying to, not to prove anything, but it happens that we're using the instruments we can play to say the vocabulary that we like to say, and that happens to be Arabic music, among other things.
And that is Rituals, performed live at a Dartmouth studio by New Sounds from Arab Lands. The ensemble is Kinan Azmeh on clarinet, Basel Rajoub on saxophone, Jasser Adjousef on viola d'amour, with Firas Sharistan on kanun.
You can find more on the ensemble and watch videos of their improvisation and find out where they're currently touring at wordofmouthradio.org.
In the words of Henry David Thoreau, if you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now put the foundations under them. Thoreau wasn't writing about constructing actual castles, but about realizing one's dreams. Sean Hurley found a New Hampshire man whose artistic pursuit of a castle in the air is actually a castle, and he's building it. Sean takes us on this radio field trip to the Kingdom of Thornton.
If you look west, from the summit of Welch or Dickey Mountain, you might see the small white smile on the distant cliff across the valley. In fact, the swoop of granite and mortar is a man-made wall, a grand terrace, as described by the man who made it, single-handedly, stone by stone, over the course of many years. Lance Keane.
Now, the grand terrace is 116 feet long and 14 feet high in the middle. And it's in a big semicircle out on the cliff face.
As it happens, there's a little bit of a castle situation going on here in Thornton. To make it less likely, more edgy, and a little higher in the air, it's a castle on a cliff situation.
Now you can see we're coming out on the cliff face here. When I just stepped out onto this cliff face 13, 14 years ago, it just took my breath away. And still, every single time I come out here, I have the same feeling. I look at this view and I say, oh my God, this is incredible. This is the coolest place in the world.
To some, the perfect spot for a picnic. To others, or maybe just a Lance, it's the perfect spot to build a castle.
Well, when I explain this project to
people. A lot of people just don't understand, I think, a castle. You know, but what I found a better way to explain it over the years is I tell people, this is my lifelong art project. And when I put it in that context, like, oh, you're an artist. Okay, so then it seems to make sense to people.
As we walk the muddy switchbacks, Lance is cut against the mountain so the building trucks can get to the site. He tells me about the origins of his castle dream.
I was a soldier in the army, and I was stationed in Germany. One of the popular things to do is to go out and visit castles on the weekend. So I really loved the style of the castles. There's some permanence. There's something special about stone.
After the army, and feeling somewhat adrift, Lance set down on paper three things he wanted for his life.
The goals were move back to New Hampshire where I grew up. I'm originally from Laconia. Find the woman of my dreams, settle down and start a family, and build a medieval stone castle.
What's eccentric there is pretty obvious. But what's common, almost universal, hides a little below the zigzag of castle making. Because this is just Lance's version of the white picket fence and the heart-shaped shutters. All his goals circle the same thing, each one a different way of saying home.
Were you shy about sharing the fact that you were doing this for a while?
I was. Yes, for the first 5 years, I was a closet stonemason. I didn't tell people about this. It was kind of my little secret passion. But then I became more open. I guess it was, fear of failure. And so something that happens that people don't tell others about such a project, because if they fail to do it, then they have to tell all their friends that they failed. So I was a victim of that. But then I decided, I'm doing this. I'm really, really going to do this.
Lance lives in nearby Campton for now. He's married with two young girls and owns a small software company. The stony and medieval action of his third goal is well underway. He's got a builder and a construction team, and the lower and main terrace are complete.
I've been working on this for many years, and people always ask me, so when are you going to be done? And I say, that's the wrong question, because this is my lifelong art project. I will never be done. The more important question is, when can you move in? Mm. And so that's what we'll be doing next year. If everything goes to plan, we hope to be in here by snowfall of next year.
After the frame is up and the family moves in, Lance will begin to add stone to the long walls and round turrets. From one perspective, it will be a home, and Lance will be a homeowner with a mortgage to pay. But it will also be a castle, and he will be the king. He may never issue royal proclamations, or wear a crown, or sit upon anything but a normal kitchen chair. But regardless, it's the castle on the ground that will count. And so, long live the king. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
To see photos of Lance Keene and his castle on that cliff in Thornton, New Hampshire, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for joining us today as we explored creativity rising up and coming alive in unexpected places. If you'd like to learn more about anything you heard on the program, you can click on over to wordofmouthradio.org, where we've posted links and photos and videos, and where you can find a deep archive of conversations about more ideas to stir your curiosity. We also invite you to join the always lively conversation on our Facebook page. That's where you can share your ideas and talk with other listeners about what's happening on the program. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Bill Berry,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to our past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook
and Tumblr
at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.